Welcome to Cloud Native Startup. I'm Emily O'Meara, your host. And today I am chatting with Marco Palladino. Marco, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me here.
And I failed to mention, of course, you're a co-founder of Kong. But I like to have people just start out by introducing themselves. And an easy way to sort of think about that is, what does your day-to-day actually look like? Like, what are your actual responsibilities? And how is that different now versus when you first started the company?
Well, so right now, my role is more strategic than it used to be. One of the biggest lessons that every entrepreneur has to learn eventually, it is to be able to trust their teams to do the right thing, right? And when you are a smaller company and you're starting out, essentially the founder at that time does everything, right? So you are the person that thinks of the product, the engineering, the business, the support. You wear 1,000 different hats. But then, of course, that doesn't scale over time. And so being able to understand which ones are the decisions that are strategic, that really have to be made, and which ones are not, which ones can be delegated, that's probably one of the biggest lessons I've learned over the years.
And so how does that translate into, like, you know, what you do? You clearly don't walk into your office and have, like, a folder that says, big strategic decision. What is it? What are the actual sort of activities?
I spend lots of time looking at opportunities inwards in the company to do better, to scale. I look at areas of inefficiency that can be improved. But quite frankly, I spend most of my time making sure that the needs of the users and the customers, which at the end of the day, it is really what matters. You know, we're here to serve our users and our customers in the vision that they want to execute. And so being able to always have a forum for them to speak up, to listen, to be their champion. That is what essentially drives my decisions. And so, you know, every week is different, but I like to think that for every new week, there's going to be two or three activities that are going to be the ones I want to have a strong outcome for. And I focus on those two or three. Everything else, it's background noise. But every week, I ask myself, what are the decisions, the best things I could do this week to improve how users and customers think of us, to make the products better, to scale into different areas, different market opportunities? What are those? And then, you know, I have my own sprint plannings, essentially, and then I execute against those.
Excellent. And then actually, I want to take a step back and ask you sort of what's Kong's origin story? How did it start? Was there a moment when you were like, oh my God, I think I'm going to start a company. I think this idea is a company.
The history of Kong truly is the history of Mashape. When I'm Italian and my co-founder is also Italian. And so when we moved to San Francisco, we moved to start a different business, an API marketplace. You see, in 2009, when we moved to San Francisco, well, besides not being able to legally stay in the country past, you know, the 3 months touristic visa, besides not having any money whatsoever, we were like in our early 20s. We came with the idea that the world would be API powered. Now, this is very clear in 2021. In 2010, people would ask ourselves, what is an API? What is an API gateway? It was starting, but it wasn't clear. And so me and Augusto came here with a different vision. We came here to build an API marketplace because when everything is powered by APIs, well, there must be the Amazon of API where developers can either publish, sell, or consume and purchase APIs to build their applications. We, at the time, came with literally no money. So we actually came with money only for 1 week. And then after 1 week, but the return flight was 3 months later. So, you know, we had to build a network from scratch. You know, we're immigrants. You know, we came here with knowing nobody. And it was a very fun adventure early on. You know, we ended up knowing Travis Kalanick before Uber. He hosted us at his place before Uber was even a thing. We met the Airbnb guys when there were 15 people because we were trying to find, you know, somebody to help us. And throughout our journey, we built our own technology, because we needed an API gateway that was scalable, that was decentralized, that could run in containers. And there was nothing in the market that we could use. And so we built it for ourselves. And then we open sourced it. And turns out that what we built for ourselves was what everybody needed. That was in 2015. So in our industry, 2013, 2014 was a market shift year. Docker came out in 2013, Kubernetes came out in 2014, and the world was moving from these large monolithic applications into microservices. And turns out that what we built for ourselves to run in this new microservices world then ended up being something that everybody else needed. So the marketplace was still existing at the time, but we had a big problem. We were amassing a large amount of users. We had at the time 300,000 developers consuming and publishing APIs. The gateway was processing trillions of requests per year, but the business model wasn't scaling that well. And so when we noticed that Kong was getting traction in the marketplace, in the industry, we decided to essentially pivot. And so we transitioned away from the marketplace into becoming a technology vendor and building Kong and supporting Kong. You know, and today Kong has over 300 million downloads and about 3 million instances running in the world every month.
So tell me a little bit about this pivot, because it's very easy to say, so we decided to pivot. And I would imagine the actual reality of making that decision, very strategic decision, and then executing on it is quite a bit more complicated. So how did you make the decision that this was a change that you needed to make from API marketplace to we're a technology vendor and we're a vendor of an API gateway?
You know, by the time we pivoted, we've been building Mashape for 5 years. And I believe that was one of the lowest lows, right? Because when you pivot, essentially you are admitting that whatever you built for 5 years prior didn't work out, and so you have to try and start something new. You know, me and Augusto, you know, I think that a rational person probably would, at that point, would have just given up. You know, why are you doing this? You know, just go and do something else. Obviously, it's not working. I believe there was a component where me and Augusto were here from a different country. We didn't really want, you know, our visa and green card was tied at the time to the company, and we didn't want to declare failure. As a matter of fact, we hated failure, and that hate for failure kept us going when, quite frankly, looking back, a normal person, a normal individual would have just, you know, call it quits. You know, I'm going to get a salary somewhere where, you know, and then maybe give it a couple of years and figure something out. We didn't want to do that. We strongly identified ourselves with the success of the company. To increase the runway at the time, we put our apartments on Airbnb. We were sleeping in the office. You know, like we didn't run with a salary for 3 years. So everything that we did was for the organization. And we were not going to let anything bad happen to it. And so when the pivot opportunity came, we actually were quite excited by the amazing response the industry had with the technology. And immediately we knew we were onto something. And that translated in a different kinds of obsession. You know, you have to be obsessed with what you do, the things that you're building. We were living and breathing Kong and the technology and the users and the use cases and the customers. We were dreaming of it. We were working long nights. You know, it was easier to do because we didn't have any families, any kids. So, you know, it was just us essentially. And of course, the team at the time that was, you know, helping us build Kong. And we were 100% obsessed. And you know, if there's something that I've learned is that with the right amount of obsession, if it can be channeled in a positive way, it always leads to something. We knew we were onto something. It wasn't an easy journey. But if you provide great technology that doesn't exist in the world, that people are using with success, I mean, that's something. That's something that you can grow. And we knew that.
Who, if anyone, was resistant to the pivot, and how did you overcome that resistance?
There were a few folks in the company that were strongly associated with the marketplace business. And for them, it wasn't easy to accept the pivot. As a matter of fact, a pivot, it's never easy for anybody. But we knew it was the right time to make that call. And the same level of obsession that we had with Kong, there were people that were hired to build on another product. And they had that same level of obsession with something that we were moving away from. And, you know, when there is this pivotal moment, it's like crossing an intersection. You know, some folks will turn left, some folks will turn right, and some folks will cross the street. And some of those people, they didn't think that was the right decision. And quite frankly, I mean, to their point, nobody could predict the future at the time, right? So it could have very well been a disastrous decision, you know, because in that point in time, the marketplace did have adoption and users and APIs. So, you know, we were just burned out by the marketplace experience. We didn't want to work on it anymore. And turns out the marketplace idea wasn't fundamentally wrong, because now we're seeing in 2021 that these API hubs or catalogs or marketplaces are essentially coming back in a more mature market. But being right at the wrong time, it's still being wrong, right? And so at the time we, you know, some of those people decided to stop working for Mashape, whereas others were very excited by Kong. And as a matter of fact, the ones that helped with Kong, it was a great opportunity for their professional growth. So at the end of the day, it worked out, but it was a very tough moment. Lots of strong emotions, I remember at that time.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you can think of, you know, sometimes it's hard to say because every situation is unique, but looking back, is there anything that you think you did particularly well? And then anything that you think you know, there was room for improvement or you would have done differently if it happened again?
You know, looking back, what we did very well was to pour, and I keep saying this word, but I really think that this was the key, pour incredible obsession in what we were building. Making sure that nothing was left, you know, apart by chance. The performance, the quality of the code base. We were feeling at that point in time that we were creating a masterpiece. That's how obsessed we were. That was something that drove the project to be what it is today. You know, and now Kong does more than just the gateway, but that opened up the opportunity for us to do more in the future, right? So for something that we could have done better was perhaps making these decisions a little bit earlier. The signs that the API marketplace business was not healthy from a business standpoint, you know, were there. You know, looking back, we were just ignoring them. So that's one thing. And then another thing that perhaps we could have done better at that time was, when it comes to Kong per se, you know, me and Augusto are entrepreneurs at heart, but we never had a company. You know, this is the first time. Every milestone that Kong is achieving, it's the first time as founders. Before Kong, we never had this amount of employees. Before Kong, we never had, and every month, it's something new for us as well. Being able to surround yourself with the right mentors and advisors and coaches, it's something that perhaps would have helped if we started doing that a little bit earlier. Simply because, you know, some of the mistakes we've done were mistakes that, you know, looking back, they were avoidable, right? And that's fine. You know, making mistakes, it's part of the professional life journey. You know, you learn from them. It's something that we're very accepting of, making mistakes, as long as we fix them down the road. But, you know, some of these mistakes could probably have been avoided and get a little bit more velocity. Now, with that said, I think we did all the right things when it comes to the project itself, right? Because this is the problem, right? You build a great project, a great product, and then you have to build a business organization. So there is a people aspect that becomes a much bigger component of building the business, even more so than the underlying technology. And when you're building a group of people, you know, it's different humanities, different expectations, different goals, different everything. And so building that as actually being more challenging than not building the product itself.
And in fact, related, how is building a company around an open source project different from another company? I'm assuming, but I don't know, the API marketplace wasn't as closely tied to any open source technology. So that's sort of an interesting comparison that you can make. You know, how is it different? What are the sort of strategy decisions that are fundamentally not the same?
Open source there is a social and human aspect of open source that does not exist in closed source products, at least to the same capacity. With open source, you have a community of people that want to build something nice, something cool. They're working together, they are arguing together, they're discussing together about what's the best way to build that software. And because the human component is so much bigger in open source software, well, then you have to deal with all the problems that comes with dealing with human expectation. Again, the humanity of people and the expectations and so on and so forth. You know, breaking the expectations in open source, it's something that nobody can recover from. When things are going to be built in a certain way, things are going to be open in a certain way, and those decisions are made, it's very hard to, you know, down the road, go back on those decisions and revert them, because then you're breaking the expectation of the community. But when you think of it, it's like managing any other human expectation with a friend, with a co-founder, with a partner. Whenever expectations are broken, it's very hard to recover from. And open source has that aspect much earlier on in the process because of the nature of the product. But open source also allows the product to get a feedback loop that otherwise it would be very hard to build in a closed source product, because you have early adopters that are very vocal about what they want, what works and what doesn't. The maintainers of the project have more chances to learn from that usage and then implement the right things to increase the adoption. Successful open source, by definition, is a project that has adoption. There is no successful open source that doesn't have adoption. How do you measure success, right? The adoption is perhaps the most important thing. But to get adoption, you have to have already dealt with the right expectations, you already have dealt with initial issues, you have listened to the early users in such a way that little by little, day after day, you end up with a successful open source project. In a closed source product, you don't have any of these. The forum for people to communicate how they feel about your project, those forums are much smaller and much... it's much harder to get the same feedback that you would get from open source. But again, that human component, it is lots of work, right? Because it's very easy to mess up with that. And like I said, once that happens, there is no going back.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think there's fundamentally, like, a community is a community. So it doesn't matter if it's an open source community or if it's, you know, your neighbors that put on a block party, there's some dynamics of community that are going to be the same. And one of them is setting expectations, like you were saying. You know, if you go to an event with your neighbors and you're talking about, you know, someone tells you that they're going to talk about traffic management versus if they tell you there's going to be live music, you're going to have different expectations. And that's the same in some ways with open source. You want people showing up and not be surprised, at least not unpleasantly.
I think it boils down to trust. Because essentially, why is missing expectations that bad? It's bad because trust gets broken. Mm-hmm. And that's very hard to rebuild. Like you said, not just in open source, in every human social interaction, of which open source is one of them.
Going back just a little bit, you mentioned avoidable mistakes. Were there any particular of like a mistake you made that you think in hindsight was like, we could have avoided that?
You see, this is a very hard question to answer because sometimes things happen because of mistakes, right? So it's very hard to say, you know, going back, if we did things in a different way, would that have led to the same outcome? Even releasing Kong, which I consider just, you know, a few minutes ago, I said, you know, one of the mistakes we've done, probably we should have released Kong much earlier. But who knows, maybe if we did release it earlier, the timing would not have been right. That transition to Kubernetes microservices wasn't there yet, and Kong wouldn't have had the same level of success. So it's very hard to go back and see. So we're here because of our mistakes and our successes, and we embrace both. To your point, there wasn't a particular mistake that was something we regret particularly, because if there were to be a mistake like that, probably I wouldn't be here speaking to you today. So, you know, there were mistakes made. There is always mistakes. I think the bigger mistakes we made was not in the technology per se, was in building the organization. You know, building a global organization across the world. You know, Kong has always been global since day one. But, you know, dealing with different expectations and building the actual org, right? So how do you deal with promotions? How do you make people happy? How do you make sure that they're being either rewarded or maybe they're going to be, you know, removed from their post if the performance is not good? How you build a business, that is something that has been and is and will be challenging because of the nature. As a matter of fact, I have lots of respect for those people that are able to build these 10,000 people, 20,000 people organization. Like, how do they do it? Like, that's incredible. The level of expectation setting that you have to put in place to make that happen, it's something that we're still learning, right, as we speak. On the other end, it's fun. Because, you know, little by little, mistake by mistake, success after success, you learn, okay, how the world moves in that area. You know, as technologists, we're hyper-focused on building the product. And up to 50 people, when the company's below 50, that's all that matters. And it's always going to matter. But then not being able to understand how to build a people organization, it's something that can be very harmful in the long run. So we have great advisors that are giving us great advice when it comes to this. And you know, the mistake perhaps was underestimating how much effort it really is. Again, as a technologist, we think the hardest part is building the product. Everything else, you know, will take care of itself. Not really.
Yeah, I was actually thinking maybe it's that, you know, good technology is table stakes, except to be honest, there's actually not so great technology that actually achieves commercial success because they succeed at some of the other things.
You see, and now I understand, you know, throughout my career, I met many founders, very successful. And sometimes, you know, I would meet a founder who would, you know, decide to be acquired, you know, when there are below 100 people, below 50 people. And I always wondered, why are you doing that? You have something great. If you keep going, it can be so much bigger. And now I understand. Some founders, they don't want to go too deep into building the actual org because it's a different game, it's a different ballpark, it's a different everything. And for some of them, it's super fun. That's the fun part. And for some of them, technology is the fun part. And that's not as fun anymore. And now I understand why they either sell or get acquired, even when they know if they keep going and building the org, they could be, you know, their valuation could be much higher. When it comes to Kong, we look at this, you know, for me, this is not just my business, it's not just my startup, it's my life journey. My 20s have been fully dedicated into building a business, into listening to users and customers and shipping technology and building this org. So for us and for me and Augusto, we are all in into building these organizations and making it look bigger because we're actually having tons of fun along the way. And it's fun to see this other side of the business, which goes above and beyond, of course, the technology that somebody's building.
And when you talk to aspiring technical founders, what are some of the like key pieces of advice that you give them?
Learning how to release trust. You see, when we start early in the days of any project, we have ownership of the spec, of the design, of the implementation, of the tests, of the documentation, how it's being used, and all of it. That doesn't scale. Eventually, in order to scale, we have to give trust to others to make the right choice. And we have to give trust to others that if they mess up, they'll fix it and do the right thing eventually. Which again, by the way, even that, it's the human component. The hardest part of building businesses, it's the human component, being able to manage that expectation to our point. And so releasing trust and learning how to do that can be something very challenging. And as a matter of fact, many technologists cannot do that. They still want to be the benevolent dictators, so to speak, of the project. It's very hard for them to release that control. And, you know, and once in a while, once every 100 projects, that actually is beneficial. But if you look at successful projects, the ones that are, you know, the vast majority of them that are successful, whoever started as the benevolent dictator was able to delegate and give trust to others. And as a matter of fact, others then become a much more important piece of the whole puzzle if they are given ownership to build what they want. As a matter of fact, it's a chance for the project to get better sometimes. But it's a very hard transition to make.
And so how does that work if you're a company and your sort of core product is related to this open source project and anybody could be contributing, or maybe not anybody, you vet them somehow, but the point is you could... you lose some control. And it's not even necessarily people who you've hired that you use control. That's where I thought you were going there. I thought you were talking about, you know, delegating to your subordinates, but it's not even people necessarily that you've hired, but other people that are in the community that you're having to sort of cede some ownership to. How does, like, does that feel dangerous? Is it dangerous? How do you manage that?
Yeah, so up until now, I was primarily focusing on the organization building per se. But if we go back at open source, to your point, you see open source, nobody actually thought that you could build a business in open source. You know, up until recently, the one and only organization that was somewhat successful was Red Hat. That was the only example of a successful open source business. Nobody believed it. You could do anything with this business model. And then, you know, companies like Elastic emerged, companies like Confluent, you know, the Kafka maintainer, you know, these types of, even Docker attempted, you know, to build a business. So Red Hat stopped being the one and only, and there was a common recurring pattern. You see, I guess the biggest expectations that any organization around open source can set with their community is the following. Open source, it's free to use, but it's not free to build. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? There must be at one point an expectation setting, a line in the sand, where the main contributor or the main maintainer says, you know, this is the line in the sand that determines all the things that we're going to be doing open source. And this is the line of the sand of the things that perhaps are not going to be open source, but are going to be revolving around the open source project. So there is going to be an ecosystem of products that can be built around an open source project. There is support, there is cloud hosting and so on and so forth. And the organization can set the line, you know, the project is open source, but if you want support, if you want access to these other features, or if you want, you know, a cloud version of it, of course, that's not open source. That's going to be part of an enterprise business that the organization wants to pursue. Typically, when that happens, it's actually not necessarily a bad thing, right? It's a good thing because it creates a healthy foundation for that open source project to keep receiving improvements. One of the biggest problems in our industry around open source, you know, is the cloud vendors, this idea that cloud vendors take open source, they host it. And that's problematic for a couple of reasons. I think that everybody should do whatever the license of the open source projects allow to do. So if the license allows them to take it and host it, that's great. What's not okay is doing that, taking out the main revenue stream from an open source vendor and not reinvesting that into the actual open source project. The parent organization has a vested interest in creating a business model that feeds back into the open source technology, that creates a benefit for everybody else. But when that business model is being created and the revenue stream is not being used to double down on the open source project, well, that's problematic for the project itself. Because then at that point, the project gets weaker. But, you know, setting the expectations, again, it's always a matter of expectations, you know, that goes a long way into creating an open source business.
So just a couple more questions, but I wanted to touch on this, that your experience as an immigrant, and particularly not just an immigrant founder, but also, you know, sort of arriving and founding your startup without having spent 5 years at VMware, for example. How do you think that that sort of changed the, not just your experience, but sort of the trajectory of the business or businesses, I guess I should say?
You see, there is a, you know, when we first came here, building the marketplace originally, you know, not having money, you know, it was really a life journey. You know, we didn't come here with the idea of building a business. We had no social support whatsoever. Me and Augusto don't come from wealthy families. You know, we always did it by ourselves. I lost 20 pounds in the first 3 months when I was here because we didn't have money for having dinner. And we did that because we wanted to build a business. You know how you skip dinner? You drink lots of water just before it's dinner time, and then you go to sleep. The water will fill you up. And if you can fall asleep, which most likely you will because you're super tired working all day, then you wake up the next day and it's another day. So for us, it wasn't just business building. It was a life journey. And we were so invested in all that we did that for us, you know, one of the biggest questions I ask to leaders is the following. Do you like to win or do you hate to lose? Right? And we hate to lose. We have passion in hating failure to a point where for us, that's not an option. And I remember back in those days, we didn't have any funding whatsoever. The last time we had, you know, the less money we had, the less time we had to make this work, and the more aggressive, you know, we became. I remember this one story. Me and Augusto had only 3 weeks left without any angel funding back in 2010. And after 3 weeks, we had to go back to Italy. And we were on the Caltrain going to a Stanford event, trying to, you know, meet investors that could potentially fund the business. And during this Caltrain ride from San Francisco to Stanford, me and Augusto, you know, we were looking at each other in the face, very tense moment. And we, you know, we said to ourselves, this is one of the last chances. You know, that's it. We only have 3 weeks left. We have to go back eventually. We have to find an angel investor. And essentially, you know, the realization that there wasn't time, you know, we arrived at Stanford. It was like a D-Day for us. You know, we went into this event, tried to meet everybody. The registration desk had the participant list with their names and email addresses. So the person who was there at the registration desk went to the bathroom at one point. We took away that registration papers with all the hundreds and, you know, thousands of names and email addresses. And we started just emailing everybody, you know, when we went back home. And for us, you know, it was lots of fun. Looking back, it was a little bit crazy, you know. Why would we put ourselves through that, you know, 12,000 kilometers away from home? You know, and so it was tons of fun. It was for sure, building this business has been the single biggest thing that has defined me as a person, as a professional, as a leader, as a co-founder, as pretty much everything. You know, our 20s were not normal, because our 20s, we were like, essentially, instead of having, you know, I'm a dropout. So I dropped out, came to the US with Augusto. We were starving, trying to build a business that was ahead of its time, trying to raise money, trying to do all of these crazy things, sleeping in other people's places. That's how we met the, you know, Airbnb founders. That's how we met Travis back in the days. You know, all of that was certainly not characteristic of what people would normally associate with, you know, being in your 20s. But it was tons of fun. And it was, you know, I'm glad that so far it worked out. And I'm glad that we're creating value in the world, and, you know, Kong and the employees and the community, we're all being rewarded for the hard work we put into this.
Excellent. Cool. Well, before we wrap up, anything else that you want to add?
I know that's pretty much it. It has been tons of fun. So I hope to do it again soon.
Excellent. Thanks for listening to this episode of Cloud Native Startup. If you'd like to learn more about positioning, messaging, and go-to-market for open source and cloud native startups, head over to my blog, positioningopensource.com. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. I'm at Emily O'Meara, and you can feel free to reach out on Twitter or on my website and blog with questions or comments. If you enjoyed this episode, also please share and help more people discover this podcast. Thank you, and we hope to have you next week.